Hello, all. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, I'd like to welcome you to the teleclass, Environmental Sampling in Healthcare Facilities. This is actually a very timely topic. There's a real increase in interest in environmental contamination, particularly I've noticed in the published in the literature. There's a lot of articles on MRSA contamination and a real refocus on that as opposed to just on hand hygiene. I find that fascinating. But the biggest part of the debate is how to measure this contamination in a feasible and a consistent way. At the APIC conference this week, I think I counted at least 5 scientific posters on environmental sampling, and many of them used very different ways to reach very different conclusions. The CDC in Atlanta has spent quite a lot of time on this issue of how to measure the environmental contamination, and at the front of that research is Dr. Lynn Seehulster. Dr. Seehulster is in the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion at the CDC, and she has given many fantastic teleclass lectures in the past. If you go to the recordings library and type in her last name, you'll be able to listen to many of those. She has been a great supporter of this program in a great many ways, and I'm really pleased that she is able to join us today and grateful for all of her support. So I'll turn the floor over to my friend, Dr. Lynn Seehulster, to bring us environmental sampling in healthcare facilities. Lynn.
Well, thanks once again, Paul, for inviting me to present this lecture on environmental sampling. As Paul mentioned, this is a wonderful opportunity to talk about a subject that is becoming increasingly important in our world of environmental infection control. So after our title slide, could we go to slide number 2, and this is where we take care of a bit of housekeeping, and no pun is intended. As we're required here at our agency, we do give you a disclaimer statement that basically says what we're presenting is what we're finding and not necessarily an official statement of opinion or policy of the CDC in Atlanta. Of course, you know, we tell you good stuff, so it's all good. Anyway, let us move to slide number 3. In slide 3, I've summarized the main points that I will attempt to cover briefly. You know, as Paul had said, there's a lot of interest. There are a lot of methods. There are a lot of different approaches to environmental sampling. So for the purpose of today, we'll really touch upon the principles and the very basic practices of environmental sampling. In essence, we'll be reviewing the things you'll need to take into consideration before you undertake a sampling project. And then we'll briefly highlight some of the methods that are used for sampling. Basically, the 3 major categories of sampling we'll try to hit on today are air, surfaces, whether they're animate or inanimate, and water. Now, interestingly, in slide 4, the CDC's HICPAC, the guideline we call the EIC guideline, the Guideline for Environmental Infection Control in Healthcare Facilities, was an opportunity to gather some of this material together so that you all in the field had one place to go to get some of this basic material. Environmental sampling was discussed briefly in the 1985 guideline on hand washing and hospital environmental control, but we do cover the subject in much more depth in the current document from 2003. So much of what I will say is reflected in the chapter entitled, or the section entitled, Environmental Sampling. And in slide 5, I give you a repeat of where you can find the guidelines. Now, since they've been out for about 5 years, many of you already have this material, but just in case if you don't, here is where this information is located. You can find the full text version of the document at the web address listed on the slide, and it is important to let you know that most of this material is found in the full text version. you won't see much of this in the Part 2 recommendations, which is in the MMWR version of the document. And if you're like me and you like a printed copy in your hand, you can either download the full text from the website or talk to the American Society for Healthcare Engineering and purchase a printed copy from their store. So at this point, in slide 6 is our little segue slide, so let's go right into environmental sampling. Slide 7, what is environmental sampling? It is a field of microbiology that, well, it borrows from clinical micro, but it is definitely not clinical microbiology. It is an approach to working with organisms found in the environment that the sampling of these organisms may require different strategies and collection methods than you would see in for the clinical samples. The important thing is that we definitely do not really support random undirected sampling. That is both expensive and time-consuming. Sampling of the environment is usually indicated when epidemiologic assessment is pointing you in the direction that an environmental source or an environmental reservoir may be at the center of an infectious disease transmission problem. And so consequently, after an EPI investigation has led you to this point, then is the time to consider the sampling of the environment as part of your investigation. In order to do this, sampling requires a lot of forethought and a lot of preparation. It requires a protocol for sampling in cultures, an analysis of results, and the context in which that analysis is conducted. And most importantly, you need a plan of action based on the interpretation of the results. In essence, if you don't quite understand why you're sampling, you should not undertake environmental sampling. In slide 8, we have some of the suggested uses for environmental sampling. As you can see, there are potential opportunities when sampling can be very, very helpful. As I mentioned, whenever an outbreak investigation, the epidemiology in that investigation points to an environmental source or reservoir. Sampling is also very commonly used when you're engaged in a research project that is focused on environmental infection control. It's a research tool that can be very, very potentially very effective. Another opportunity for sampling is more from, say, an industrial hygiene point of view when you're monitoring a potentially hazardous situation. A good example would be if you've installed new carpeting in an area in the hospital, but people are complaining of headaches or other adverse conditions, it may be necessary to do some sampling to see if the carpeting is off-gassing, perhaps of some formaldehyde. Another opportunity, and this is probably where you see more of the research such as reported at APIC or CHICA, is when you're evaluating a change in environmental infection control practices or for quality assurance purposes. And as you might guess, since there is such a great interest now in multiply drug-resistant organisms and their control, you can see that environmental sampling may be a useful tool as we move from what methods we used to do in cleaning and disinfection back in the good old days to what we might need to do now. In some instances, and I'll point this out later, there are folks who are calling for a periodic regular maintenance of equipment, such as our HVAC systems. And increasingly, and this sometimes does get associated with outbreak investigations, there may be legal issues called into place. Now, currently, there's are at least two situations where routine monitoring is part of the mainstream and are strongly suggested, the first of which is the biological monitoring of sterilization processes, your autoclaves, your low-temperature sterilizers, and in many instances, your equipment to perform high-level disinfection. All of these have some form of monitoring for quality assurance purposes. Another is the monthly culturing of water used in hemodialysis and for the final dialysate use dilution. So these are the areas where we have some routine environmental sampling that is done. In slide 9, two things to keep in mind. As I mentioned, environmental sampling is expensive. It's time-consuming. It is subject to many variables. Therefore, this is something that needs to be given a lot of forethought and think through the process before you get underway. And interestingly, especially in our communities and in some instances in the hospitals, such as happening in the Midwest and the U.S., with flooding and so forth, if there is a need for sampling of your environment in efforts to clean up and remediate the affected areas that might be subject to water damage and flooding, you find that many of our sampling opportunities are subject to some sort of review and investigation. And if you're doing things in, say, efforts to remediate structures and so forth, you may find that the records of sampling are subject to disclosure. And this quote in this slide comes from a textbook just recently released called Recognition, Evaluation, and Control of Indoor Mold. Sampling is a public exercise and is always subject to disclosure. Therefore, the investigator is required to minimize false negatives and, more rarely, false positives. At this point, let's move to air sampling. That's the one that we have a good deal of information and a good deal of use in healthcare in slide 10. Air sampling is done, shall we say, in two approaches. You can either do microbiologic sampling of air, or you can do particle counting of air. But basically, why do we do microbiologic sampling? Primarily if we are needing to determine bacteria and fungi present in biological aerosols. The methods that we use to sample microorganisms from the air, the three major ones are impingement in liquids and impaction on solid surfaces. A sort of subset of that impaction is sedimentation. You may have heard of the use of settle plates in operating rooms and in other clean areas. Those are the three main methods, and we'll give a little compare and contrast about those methods in the coming slides. But as with all sampling, you need to understand what is being measured and why you're doing it. And it's important for this and all the other opportunities for sampling to fully describe the circumstances, the ambient conditions in the space or the area that you are sampling. With slide 11, here are some of the considerations that need to be taken into account when attempting to do microbiologic sampling for air. What you'll be looking at is primarily the characteristics of an aerosol or else what is floating in ambient air. So if you are looking at an aerosol, you will probably need to consider the particle size in that aerosol, the amount of inert material, any concentration of microorganisms, so you can either adjust the volume of air that you sample. There are a number of environmental factors, primarily relative humidity, temperature, air currents, the specifications of the HVAC system in the area where sampling is done. All of these need to be documented so that your results can be interpreted with a proper context. And then once you have determined, yes, we're going to do sampling, the next question is what type of sampler and how many individual samples, the duration of collection, and how much sampling material do you need to conduct a good solid data point for that space. We'll go into different types of samples in a following slide. And then, once you have also considered the possible types of organisms you are going to be looking for, now obviously it's not that you will know everything exactly in an aerosol, but if you were looking for bacteria, you will probably be selecting a media that will be suitable for the initial growth of a wide variety of potentially like gram-positive organisms, maybe some gram-negatives, but a broad spectrum media that would support the growth of a diverse group of organisms. If you're looking for fungi, you may be selecting media that is more appropriate for their growth and recovery. And this also will show you the benefit of perhaps collecting more than just one sample in the space where you are sampling. You can have one sampler set up for the fungal media and another one for bacteria. So again, you give this some thought ahead of time, and then you can set up your sampling protocol to give you the best possible collection. And obviously, you will also need an appropriate assay method for your target organisms. In essence, with most environmental samples, you will probably see incubation and culture methods that are not exactly like those in clinical microbiology. The temperatures may be more like room temperature or somewhere in between room temperature and 37 degrees centigrade. The sampling, the duration of culture may be longer than the typical clinical microbiology specimen would require. So, again, it is a phase of microbiology that is a little different from the clinical approach to assay. And very importantly, the conditions of transport, bringing the specimen from the point of collection to the laboratory, is very important. Many of the organisms that are sampled may not require keeping the specimen at 4 degrees because they might be slow growing or they are tolerant of room temperature conditions. But on the other hand, there may be a need to sample material that was present at the time, that is the concentration of microorganisms present at the time. And if you want to slow their continued growth down so that their numbers are more reflective of what you observed at the time of sampling rather than 5, 10, 20 hours later, you can put those organisms at a lower temperature to slow down their growth. In slide 12, here's just a picture example of some of the common types of air samplers, and obviously this is not meant to be an endorsement of these particular models and their companies, but rather just to demonstrate that air samplers are devised to provide a particular feature for the sampling. Item A is a slit impactor. This particular model is somewhat self-contained so that you need no additional vacuum pumps or other pieces of equipment necessary. Item B is an example of a glass impinger, again, where air And aerosols are collected onto the surface of a liquid. And the item in C is an example of a sieve impactor, where air is brought into the collector, allowed to pass through tiny holes in each one of those stages, with the diameters of the holes varying, going from larger to narrower. And in that method of sampling, you can get an idea of the size of particles and their concentration at the same time. In slide 13, this is a compare and contrast chart that compares the three methods, the impingement, the impaction, and sedimentation, to tell you, in essence, the main principle of how the device performs, what each device is suitable for measuring, what kind of media or surface is typically used with the device, and some points to consider when thinking on or not to use the device for your sampling purposes. In general, the impingement and the impaction are efficient methods of sampling, requiring some form of a vacuum to draw air into the sampler, and the difference being that impingement is liquids, impaction is done on solid surfaces. Both are suitable for measuring viable microorganisms. The impingement liquid format is also suitable for measuring the organisms in water aerosols. One thing is certainly true, impingement has been a very classical method of sampling when attempting to look for Legionella in the aerosols generated by point-of-use fixtures or shower heads or even in the vicinity of cooling towers and so forth. The impaction on solid surface, however, is probably the more commonly used air sampling method for air microbiology. You will find it is very commonly used for looking for bacteria and fungi. They are very efficient samplers, and you can collect high volumes of air in short periods of time. You will notice that in none of the three air sampling methods do we talk about sampling for viruses. The most practical use of microbiologic air sampling is limited to that of bacteria and fungi. And viruses are a very specialized demand for sampling. We very rarely see this in our healthcare settings. And if one were wanting to sample for airborne viruses, at that point I would strongly suggest to secure the assistance of a professional environmental microbiology consulting service, because it does require very sophisticated devices and approaches to sampling. We have used settle plates in many of the outbreak investigations in healthcare. It's not a very practical method because it relies on gravity to bring particles and microorganisms to the surface. It's very simple, though, and it may suit the purpose for your need for sampling. We have seen its use in a number of investigations in very clean environments, such as bone marrow transplant areas and operating rooms. And slide 14, before you do microbiologic air sampling, again, some summary items of consideration. You need to determine your analytical approach, whether or not you want a simple yes-no answer, a qualitative or a quantitative answer. You want to look at particle size, concentration of microorganisms over time. One thing to keep in mind is with microbiologic sampling, by the time you get your results, you are somewhat down the road in time from the day you took your samples. So microbiologic air samples are certainly not a measure of real-time assay. The counts you get with microbiologic air sampling are always compared to similar sampling done with outdoor air. And this is important to establish that what is circulating in air in your facility is reasonably the same makeup of diverse microorganisms compared to what you're seeing in the outside. The next slide. The other problem with microbiologic air sampling is we still have many unresolved issues. In this slide and slide 16, we give you some of the problems that we have with microbiologic air sampling. Perhaps the most, there are two most important ones which are very troubling, and that is that we do not have action level standards for the air when it comes to microbiologic air sampling. We also do not have a good correlation, especially with fungi, between the strains we find in the environment comparing to those in clinical specimens. That's a statement that you'll see on slide 16. And for these reasons, this is why we've not suggested that, for example, in bone marrow transplant units, that you were conducting a routine assessment for fungal strains such as Aspergillus, because we do not know what the infectious dose is for this organism, and we don't have an action level above which it's not safe for our patients, below which it is. We just have so many unanswered questions that it is difficult to suggest that microbiologic sampling of air should be done routinely. With slide 17, however, we move to a form of air sampling that does have a great deal of use on a daily basis, and that is particle sampling. This is very simple to perform, and it is real-time measurement. It is commonly used to help evaluate the performance, the operation of your HVAC system. It is definitely a useful tool for determining filtration efficiency, and it will help you to give your surgeon an answer when he says the air in my operating room is not clean. You can do particle sampling to either support his statement or support those of the engineers. So we find it sometimes a very helpful thing to bring some questions to rest. Anyway, another very, very useful application of particle sampling is used to measure the effectiveness of construction barriers. Now, there probably isn't a hospital in North America that is not undergoing some renovation or adding an addition or renovating a ward or building a building next to existing facility where some concern for keeping outdoor air particles out, minimizing the spread of indoor particles. Particle counters can be a very useful tool to help with the decisions you need to make regarding constructions and their maintenance. And in slide 18, we have some, again, picture examples of particle counters. These are two versions of a counter which is called a condensation particle counter. Again, not meant for endorsement, but just as an example of what they look like. The practicality of the device on the right is that you can, as a person sampling a particular space, can use the telescoping wand of the device to place that under the space under a door so you can sample the area of a closed room, or you can sample up into a register, an HVAC supply or exhaust register with the use of that telescoping wand. So it's very very practical device, and these devices can be set for different particle sizes, and that can also help again, with determining what types of particles, whether they are large aggregate particles or smaller individual particles. Slide 19 is an example And you may be familiar with some of the slides that follow, which I have, with permission, borrowed from Andy Streifel. As you know, he's got the market on the concepts with the particle counting and is a strong advocate for their use. This gives you an example of how particle counts can help determine what we call rank order of moving from, say, from dirty to clean areas with the benefit of filtration. And this looks at particle counts that were obtained from several areas in a hospital. The filtration efficiency is listed there on the far right column. As I mentioned before, with microbiologic counts, the same is true for particle counts. You are always comparing your counts to that of outdoor air. And in this particular instance, the number of particles per cubic centimeter are 8,500 particles, and that's the outside. When you look at the particle counts that were obtained in the lobby, and you see in the lobby the filtration efficiency for that space is listed as 90%. What we're kind of looking for when we're looking at particle counts in a particular filtered area is a reduction by that percentage, and so that what is left in the room should be plus or minus within, say, 10% of the efficiency. In this particular situation, 10% remaining in the room would be approximately 850 particles per cubic centimeter. And you can see the value here is 1,500. When you do the calculation, you find that value of 1,500 represents approximately 17-18%. So it's a little higher than we would expect based on filtration efficiency alone. But consider that a lobby may have a door to the outside or a great deal of people traffic in the area. And so there may be opportunities for intrusions of particles in the area from people or coming in from the outdoors. But nevertheless, this is not a particle count that would send off bells and whistles and then cause alarm at that level. Let's look at the bone marrow transplant area. And here the area is protected with HEPA filtration on the supply air at 99.97%. The particle counts in the corridor of the bone marrow transplant area came in at 450. Again, a little bit higher than we would like to see, but this is a corridor, and so there's traffic in the corridor, and there were probably a number of people moving about during the time when the samples were taken. If you look at the room counts, the particle counts in the rooms, then you start to see that, 30 of the 32 rooms have particle counts that are probably within our expectation based on the filtration efficiency from the HEPA filters. For two of the rooms, however, the counts were exceeding 500 particles per cubic centimeter. Now, that very definitely is a particle count that seems excessive. And so the first thing you would do is check to see if the supply air serving those rooms is of a particle count that we would expect for a properly functioning HEPA filtration for those areas. But more than likely, you might suspect that there are either a source of particles being generated within those rooms, adding therefore to the counts, or else there is a penetration or some break in the seal to the room, or it's possible that someone may have left the door ajar for an undisclosed period of time. That phenomenon was not known and or not made aware to other people, and so there are a number of things that we would have to take into account to determine why two of the rooms are having more particles or a lessening of the indoor air quality for those areas. But you can kind of see now how the particle count can be helpful in that regard. In slide 20, these are some of the considerations for doing a more routine use of particle counting. Again, you'll see most of these are related to the functioning of the HVAC system on a routine basis. Particle counts can be used to help establish baseline data, and this is very helpful to establish and part of the commissioning of newly renovated or new space within a hospital. Particle counts can also be helpful during an outbreak situation. It can be helpful to rule out ventilation as a source of the environmental problem. And for routine surveillance, again, the most important thing is that these counts would be used to detect deviations from baseline data or baseline expectations. You can find more common use, again, by monitoring the effectiveness of construction barriers or, again, doing some collection of data for HVAC performance. In slide 21, we won't dwell on this much because, in a sense, I've covered most of those items as well. Again, to realize that air is not sterile, and even in bone marrow transplant areas, you will not routinely get zero particle counts because there are numerous sources of particles from skin, from clothing, that we track in as we move about the room, move from one space to the next. So lots of places and resources for particles to come into our space. Let's move now to environmental surface sampling. This, too, is, again, becoming very popular. Once again, the decision to sample surfaces should be driven by epidemiology. Infection control concerns can also be addressed. There are a number of sampling methods. The ones that we will talk about primarily will be sampling with the use of sponges or wipes or swabs. Direct immersion is another, but we won't talk much about that at this point. Containment is another one where you're looking at the interior surfaces of a container, and then direct surface sampling with Rodac plates. So the ones we'll talk about today are the ones most commonly used, such as to monitor for MRSA or other microorganisms on surfaces, the use of sponges and swabs, wipes, and Rodac plates. In slide 23, again, this is probably starting to sound like a broken record because the same principles hold true for sampling on surfaces. You need a lot of background preliminary information gathering, looking to see where you're sampling, the numbers of specimens that you would need to get an accurate data point, whether or not you need controls or comparative samples. You need to describe fully the ambient conditions surrounding sampling. And as before, with all sampling, a plan of action based on the results. I can't stress the importance of that. If you don't have an idea of what to do with the results, you shouldn't even begin to do the sampling. Slide 24 is another compare and contrast chart. This compares the wipe method, the swab method, and the Rodac method. And as you can tell, again, these are all very, very useful. The Rodac plate, however, is probably limited just to the detection of bacteria and fungi. Others, the swabs and the wipes, can be used with appropriate media and transport and culture methods to look for some viruses. But again, you would need probably an environmental microbiologist to help with those types of samplings. Pretty much, these methods are primarily used for non-porous surfaces. This is the hard surface. The swab is more amenable to sampling uneven surfaces and surfaces with some topography, so that is one thing to consider. Wipes are good for small, flat areas. Wipes can also be used for hands and skin, and so this is where the wipes can be looking at what is on animate surfaces. Now, swabs can be used as well for animate surfaces, but in many instances, use of a wipe, especially for a qualitative assessment of what is on skin, is one way of going about. Most of these will be used to either detect organisms that are naturally present on a surface or remaining after you have performed some task with the surface. So, in essence, you are looking at perhaps the extent of contamination or the effectiveness of methods to decontaminate the area. In slide number 25, one point that I did not mention earlier, but certainly is true for both air sampling, water, and surface sampling, and that is the need to maintain asepsis. For example, not only do you need to have good aseptic technique, but virtually all of the materials you'll use need to be sterile before you undertake sampling. And in many instances, you will find sampling is done in a two-man team where one person is primarily responsible for collecting the sample and the other is responsible for the handling of the supplies. The asepsis aspect of sampling is very, very important. In slide 26, I'll just give you some of a very, very brief sense of what is involved with the wipe method. This is using a small 2x2 gauze sponge pads. Wipe methods can be qualitative or they can be quantitative. And if you go with a quantitative approach, what you will need is a sterile template that is something that defines a surface area where you will be sampling. And in this instance, when you are using these templates, you will need a new sterile template for every different surface you are sampling. You can't use one template and then transfer it to the next surface and so forth. So, again, this is one of the things we do to maintain the asepsis practice. In slide 27, these are just some of the high points of the swab surface sampling procedures. Again, these can be used for surfaces that are flat and smooth, or they can be used for surfaces that have some topography. And if you are doing, again, a quantitative approach to sampling with swabs, you will need, again, the template and a new template for every new surface that you are going to swab. General, all of these will require some moisture, and using a moistened gauze sponge or swab will help to pick up organisms more efficiently. In the slide 28, here's just a brief overview of the RODAC plate method. This is, again, a method that is used to directly sample a surface, and basically is a very efficient sampling procedure where you press the plate onto the surface, cover it up, send it to the lab, and it is your assay system right there. The difference between the RODAC methods and the swabs and the wipes is you will probably need to restrict the use of RODAC plates to previously cleaned or surfaces that you expect to be limited contamination. RODAC plates are subject to overgrowth if there's an overabundance of microorganisms and organic material present. So consequently, you will not be using Rodac plates for visibly dirty or irregular surfaces. Because you are doing perhaps some chemical cleaning or disinfectant treatment of the surface before you do a Rodac plate, you will find that you will need to use chemical neutralizers and have those incorporated in the agar medium. This will help to negate or cancel out the continuing residual effectiveness of the disinfectants. And the purpose there is primarily to keep false negatives to a minimum. When you're using a Rodac plate, it is a press straight down and lift up. It is not used to sort of wipe over a surface or twist or move it around, because if you do that, you will smear the material over the surface of the plate, and you'll have a limited opportunity for doing accurate counting. In slide 29, because there are sampling opportunities that may require the use of neutralizers for, again, eliminating continuing effectiveness of disinfectants, this slide summarizes some material from Denver Russell's chapter in the Block textbook, where we have listed, there are six different categories of disinfectant active ingredients and neutralizers or neutralizing media that can be used to counter continuing residuals of these disinfectants. And you'll see that most of them are very simple chemicals, or in some instances, just using high levels of protein can be a sufficient inactivator of a disinfectant. So you can have a combination of either a specific chemical interacting with a residual, or just adding more organic matter, we'll say inert organic matter, to counter the residual of that disinfectant. In slide 30, moving into what we're seeing probably more and more is kind of the new wave of surface sampling, and that is some of the methods that are now used for visual assessment of remaining organic matter or microorganisms. And that is the use of some of these either fluorescent type of chemicals that will fluoresce under UV light, or the use of ATP methods that would measure inorganic matter residual ATP activity. You will note that the most recent, the MDRO, Management of Multi-Drug Resistant Organisms, that guideline from CDC and HCPAC from 2006 had material that called upon infection control practitioners to consider using some form of environmental surveillance when attempting to deal with a persistent MDRO problem. And I think you will find in the field that there's a move away from just the visual inspection to some of these more sophisticated methods. The thing with the ultraviolet light form of detection is there you find mostly qualitative approaches to looking at the contamination on surfaces, whereas with the ATP methods, you do have an opportunity for a more quantitative approach. And very quickly, in slide 31, this was a slide that I had used in one of my earlier teleconferences. This is some data produced from Carling et al. Out of Boston, where they used their particular concoction of gluten, detergent, and the fluorescent indicator as a colorless material they could wipe onto surfaces, then go through a cleaning method, and then use the UV indicator to fluoresce the residual material. This is the example I show here demonstrates that what they're reporting is the percentage of surfaces in those different categories where residual fluorescence was revealed. So it's more of a a very qualitative approach to sampling, but it can still be an effective tool to help you determine what you need to do differently in your cleaning method. In slide 32, this is data just hot off the press out of the University of Wales Institute, where they used the ATP method to evaluate cleaning. And these data are just a portion of the data that was collected from several hospitals, where they used what they called a standard cleaning protocol compared to a modified cleaning protocol, and using the ATP with the relative light unit of measurement to determine the relative effectiveness of cleaning. Now, unfortunately, the details for the cleaning methods were not very detailed, but the modified method emphasized a little more elbow grease and methods to ensure better drying and steps to take to prevent recontamination. And in essence, going with a quantitative approach to looking at the effectiveness of cleaning can help in the eventual establishment of the benchmark. What value would you look at? What would be a goal for the cleaning to assure that the method is used thoroughly and consistently? And ultimately, hopefully, these data will be applied with incidence data as well. Anyway, I see we're getting close to the end of our hour. Let me just move quickly to slide 33, which is water sampling. Water sampling is very interesting in the sense that the primary use of water sampling in our hospitals has been primarily for Legionella determination, but it certainly can be used to look at other waterborne organisms as well. The one thing to consider is for waterborne microorganisms, they live in what we consider a stressed environment. It is not very often nutrient-rich, and so if you were to use a culture method that is loaded with protein and nutrients, they could probably go, ah! And they will not grow, and you will have results that are not truly indicative of what you see in your water supply. So you use a method and incubation temperatures that reflect or are as close as you can get to their reflecting their stressed environment. Another thing to consider is, especially when looking at potable water, which is finished water, you need to have a neutralizer in your sampling protocol, such as sodium thiosulfate, to inactivate the residuals of the chlorine that would often be present in water. In slide 34, these are just some considerations for doing sampling for Legionella. You'll be looking at both the point-of-use devices and the system surfaces. If you are looking at faucet aerators and shower heads, you would sample with a swab these surfaces first and then collect water samples after the shower heads and the aerators are removed. And with Legionella, there is a specific culture medium that will support their growth as the buffered charcoal yeast extract. And this is summarized from the Appendix C in the Environmental Infection Control Guideline, which you can go to for some more details. And speaking of more details, slide 35 gives you some resources for more information, more detailed information about collecting samples in the environment for biological materials. Most of the particle count information comes from the EIC guideline. The bond reference will give you some considerations for sampling of medical devices, especially those with lumens. And all of these sources of information will give you good practical pieces of advice, so that if you do conduct sampling within your institution with your current microbiology staff. You will probably have reasonable success, but it will also give you opportunities to ask the right questions when you go outside and seek the help of professional. And with that, we will go to slide 36 and say thanks for your time and attention, and happy sampling.
Thank you very much, Lynn. That was really interesting. It's a good start, as you say, on what is probably a very large topic. If you get very specific, it's a huge topic. And I appreciate that you emphasized that if there isn't a use for the information, if there isn't an action plan to do something with the results of the data that you're collecting, there's really no point in collecting it at all.
Exactly. And another thing to consider, and this is sometimes what happens when the question about Legionella contamination comes up, if you sample either air, water, or surfaces and you find something, what are you going to do about it? You know, what are you going to do about it? Because now you have evidence that something is present, so now this is where that plan of action comes into play. What are you going to do about it? Do you need to do something about it? These are our big, big questions.
I will add a disclaimer, as did Lynn, that where there were specific products or companies shown or mentioned, they are not considered, they should not be considered an endorsement. A Teleclass Education doesn't endorse or advertise any particular product or company. So I thank you for that.
I have a question about air exchanges, and I've got the grid from Public Health Agency of Canada mm-hmm. with air exchanges and how long you have to leave a room vacant. And I'm just wondering if I can see more reference on that, like to back up, do I want my room to be 99.9% free of any possible, in this case, TB organisms, 99? Is there any reference that would give me more to go on to take to my engineering department?
When you say a reference in terms of supporting the values of that particular table?
Yeah, and I'm having a hard time convincing people they need to leave a room empty as long as it appears they do, and maybe that's not correct. You know, maybe we're wrong. We're pretty novice at that.
Well, one thing you can do is if you take a look, I think it's in both the Environmental Infection Control Guideline as well as the more recent CDC TB guideline. We have that chart in both of those guidelines, but we've also got the references that from which that chart was developed. And interestingly, that chart was developed in the spirit of trying to enhance TB control within the airspace, the occupied space. I might add that perhaps the TB guideline would perhaps provide more of an update as to whether or not it's appropriate for having the room 99% clean versus 99.9% clean. And some of that rationale might be in that TB guideline.
Terrific. I'll be looking at it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
So I thank you very much for your attention, all. And Lynn, a special thank you to you for yet another fantastic teleclass lecture. Thank you very much.
You are welcome.
And until we speak again next time, folks, goodbye.